Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts from thehammerspeaks.com, David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just two Daves talking all the Steelers football you could ever want. And now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave, Season 2, Episode 61. It's Dave Bryan of SteelersDepot.com. He's got the most comprehensive Steelers site on the internet, and I'm David Todd from TheHammerSpeaks.com. Dave, a post-Merry Christmas to you. I hope it was a good one.
Nice and quiet. I didn't have to do a damn thing. So, yeah, it was. How about yourself?
Very nice here in Pittsburgh, and Santa, since we talked, Santa and the Steelers got another win on the board, so the Steelers go into the last week of the season 11-4, but their fate's still up in the air. They can still be the number 1, 2, or 5 seeds in the AFC. I guess if we sit back and look at it at the beginning of the season, this is a position you wouldn't mind being in, but clearly the Steelers don't really hold their own destiny in their hands in the sense that the most likely outcome is a number 5 seed, but I certainly wouldn't rule out a number 2 seed.
Yeah, it's funny how all of a sudden now the Bengals become our best friend here heading into the final week at home against the a beat-up Ravens team, too. I mean, let's not discount that. They've got some injuries on their side of the ball. Anquan Boldin, of course, with that torn meniscus, you know, is not going to be available to them this week. They lost David Reed, kick returner slash wide receiver. I wouldn't say that's a huge, huge loss there, but, you know, it is depth on the wide receiver end of things. They got a few concussions in there to a few linebackers, I think. One of their linemen had some rib issues, I think. So they're going to be a team limping into Cincinnati where they haven't had much success at Paul Brown Stadium. And it's kind of funny that the Bengals kind of hold their own future in their hand, and yet they're begging people to sell the game out.
Yeah, you're right. Yonda, the offensive lineman, might have a broken rib. And I think one of their DBs, Williams, had the concussion along with a linebacker. So we'll see what happens in that game. Cincinnati, you know, interesting stuff on Saturday as we had the Steeler game kind of pretty much in hand by the middle of the third quarter. And you turn your attention to what's going on in the other games, and it looked like Cincinnati up 20-0, I think, at the half, and the Ravens up 17-0 at the half. We're both going to coast to victory, and it turned out that both of them came really down to the last couple minutes where Phil Taylor of the Browns jumped offside with 2 minutes to go in a situation where the Ravens certainly weren't going to go for it on fourth down, and they probably wouldn't even have tried the field goal. So there's a chance that the Cleveland would have gotten the ball back down 6, and then Arizona early Doucette drops a pass or falls down as a pass is thrown to him on fourth down, wide open in the end zone that would have tied the game. So I guess for Steeler fans, they got one of the two things they wanted. That's the game you actually wanted the Bengals to win so that this game mattered. And unfortunately, the Browns put a game second half but for Cleveland, and we'll certainly get into Cleveland because they are the Steelers' opponent Sunday, but we'll get into that this week. But they did a nice job coming back and making a game of it. Peyton Hillis with another good game, so that's 2 weeks in a row. He's played well. You talked about it in your preview on Friday that Seneca Wallace can be dangerous. He didn't manage the game particularly well, particularly at the end of the first half when they botched up having the ball at the 3-yard line and got no points out of it as time ran out. But the AFC North, always tough games, and I, you know, I expect both games to be relatively good games.
Yeah, I'm glad you hit on that. That's one thing I wanted to hit on was the end of the first half of the Browns. Boy, that Shurmur, boy, he's got to take control there and do something. That was just a nightmare what happened to them at the end of that first half. And I want to make sure we got to a question we threw out there. If anybody had some questions today, Twitter follower, I think it was the real Brian C on Twitter, asked how these games getting flexed next week affects things. And I think the main thing that they were trying to do is they wanted to get these into a late game situation where they could adjust some of their viewerships on CBS and all, as far as moving the Steelers game and the Ravens Bengals game. But also I think now too you're in a situation where all these games are going on at one time, and at least two that the Bengals won't a lot of what they're, you know, them depends on. Even if they lose against the Ravens, they can still get in if certain things happen. So now I think all those games are the late games, later in the afternoon game. So everybody will be scoreboard watching, but it kind of ensures that everybody's going to have to play, you know, not knowing what other outcomes are. So that would really only be the real ramification, I think, of seeing these games flexed.
Yeah, and I think they did that in a big way to help the teams that were competing against the Bengals, because if, God forbid, the Steelers lose to the Browns and that game were at 1 o'clock, the Ravens wouldn't have anything to play for. They'd be automatically the second seed, assuming New England won their game, so they could roll over against the Bengals, and the Bengals would get in, and the Jets, the Titans, and potentially the Raiders would all be knocked out. So ramifications all around the league. I think it's the right thing to do for competitive reasons. So that's why the Steelers will be kicking off at 4:15 in Paul Brown Stadium on Sunday. So, Dave, the Saturday game, we talked about it kind of at length, that this is a game that was probably one of the least anticipated Steeler games in years. It didn't have a big impact on where they're going to be in the standings. Of course, these games still matter. They all matter at some level. But an NFC West opponent that we don't see very often, a team that has only two wins coming in, missing their marquee quarterback, missing some of their other solid players. And I guess the only concern coming into the game was with Charlie Batch at quarterback, is this a game the Steelers not take lightly, but just aren't able to put a lot of points on the board and keep a team like the Rams around and in the game, and ergo it ends up a close game. And we saw what happened with a couple of these games here late in the season on Saturday and Sunday. The line started to move in. The Steelers, I think, were a 16.5-point favorite at the beginning of the week. It went to about 13 when Ben was declared to be unlikely to play, that Charlie Batch was going to get the start. And actually, at game time, it went all the way down to 10, and that 10 was enough to entice me to get fully involved.
I hear you. I stayed away from that because you just didn't know what you were going to get from Batch and all. And let's talk about Charlie's performance. I think you said that you've been reading or hearing a lot of people thinking Charlie Batch is the man. I threw out a lot of sarcastic comments on Twitter, and it's amazing how people just don't get the sarcasm these days. Hey, Charlie Batch, he played a great game. He played a Charlie Batch type game, and I told you before we got on the air here that Charlie played like he was 35. he managed the game. He did not. Charlie Batch is a quarterback that's not going to give the game away. We saw that as far back as week four of the season last year against the Ravens, where they had the Ravens pretty much beat, and except for some late miscues, false start, and problem on the punt return. I think Sylvester or Kieran Fox, I think it was, had a key penalty there that pretty much gave the Ravens an opportunity to win that game. Batch is not going to lose a game for you. And his one interception in this game on Saturday, he slipped coming out of center, and Antonio Brown slipped out in the route. It was an easy interception. But outside of that, 15 for 22 for 208 yards. And, Charlie did what Charlie does.
Right. He did just fine. He showed some good mobility, particularly on the Steelers' second offensive play, I think it was, when he ducked under the pass rush and avoided a sack and threw a sideline kind of a wheel route to Mendenhall, who'd come out of the backfield and gained, I think, 35 yards on the play. Did that again later in the game, was able to step up in the pocket a few times. He found Hines Ward once. He found, I think, Mike Wallace on another. So I do think his mobility and veteran savvy, if you will, did contribute to the win. He made a couple bad throws. He had an easy out throw that he missed badly. He made a decent throw to Mike Wallace on the deep ball. He throws it a little further, and Mike Wallace, coasts into the end zone. And as it was, he had to kind of step back and ended up down on the one. But Charlie did just fine. The Steelers, the Pittsburgh media has been critical in the sense that this fan base and team shouldn't take anything positive out of this win because they beat such a bad team. Well, you beat the team that's scheduled to play you that weekend. That's your job. There's certainly things to point at, and we'll discuss here, the run defense, some of the third down conversions that you'd like to see them perform better. But at the end of the day, they won the game 27-0, and that's what they get paid to do. So it's on to Cleveland. But Dave, I guess, you know, just in general, let's first talk about the decision about starting Batch. I think we're past the decision about starting Ben in San Francisco. I think you and I were both okay with that. There's still people who are disappointed about it. We come into Sunday's game. Are you pretty much taking the same approach? If Ben is kind of 80% or 90%, do you go with Ben, or are you comfortable and say, look, I'd really like to give Ben an extra 5 days and not risk any further injury. So regardless, if he's not, 80% or 90%, he shouldn't go, and we'll go with Charlie again.
I'd like to get Ben some work in this game. I know several people are saying hold him out to the playoffs, but let's look over the last course of the few games the Steelers have had. The offense has kind of not been they haven't been in rhythm completely all season, but the last few games, Kansas City, the game against the 49ers, of course, now he was injured. The Cleveland game tucked in there as well, too. Of course, Ben was injured in that. You would like him to get some snaps, in my opinion. So basically, my opinion would be is if he's able to practice this week, by, let's say, Thursday and Friday, in some capacity, I say you give him a go on this. Do you play him the whole game? Well, hopefully not. If you can get up big on the Browns this week, and hopefully you can get Charlie into the game, is that the way I think they're going to go? I really don't know. You could see a situation where they dress him once again, like they did this past week. Let Charlie start, and if things kind of get out of hand and not going the right way, then they break the glass in case of emergency. I just kind of worry about having a quarterback miss so much time heading into the playoffs, and especially if we don't get the bye week here, by winning the division. So what's your view on it?
Yeah, I'd like to hear the doctor report, the medical reports as well, and that obviously will be a big contributing factor. I kind of take a different view on whether you start him or not. I do not want to bring him into the game if he doesn't start. If you don't deem him good enough to start the game, I think you just accept your fate. And if you end up being the fifth seed because either you lose or the Ravens win, so be it. But if he's not deemed good enough to start, then let's get him ready to start that next game on the road, if that's what it's going to be, and prepare for that. So my view is, again, I really questioned the decision to dress him in the game on Saturday. I didn't see any point to that. Obviously, great having him on the sideline and everything else, but I don't want my head coach tempted to use him in that kind of scenario when we haven't given him the, you're good enough to start message. So I kind of say, you dress them and you start them, or you don't dress them at all and take your fate as it comes.
Well, they dressed them, because, heck, we don't really know what he was dressed underneath those coats and all he had the other day. But from what I understand, he did have his gear on just in case. But, you had enough inactives anyway that you filled up the inactive list. So regardless if he dressed,
I guess you could have, I was looking at it, and you could have had Meredith and Woods, and I don't know if they would have, either one of them would have contributed on special teams or any way, shape or form. But I wouldn't have done it.
I just would like to personally, David, something about resting these quarterbacks the final weeks. Now it's one thing. Now, if he's not able to play, if he's not able to practice this week, then most certainly, like last week, he just was not able to practice on the short week. The flight back, evidently that thing swelled up a little bit on him. But, how many days, by the time Sunday rolls around, how many days will it have been since he last played, against San Francisco? And how many days has it been since the actual injury took place? So, now, guys like Pouncey, let him sit. Guys like Lamar Woodley, let him sit. Because, I think we can win without either one of those two guys in the lineup there. Emmanuel Sanders the same way. But I would like to see if Ben is able to take snaps on either Thursday or Friday and is, as you say, 80%. I would like to see him get some work in this game. But, that's just me. I'm the ultimate pessimist. I'm an optimist, but I'm a pessimist when it comes to something like getting your quarterback ready for the playoffs.
Let's get into the game on Saturday, and let's talk about the running game, because the Rams came in here as one of the worst, if not the worst, run defense in the NFL, And as a running offense, you have Steven Jackson, who is, as he like to call himself, a bell cow of a back. He wants to go out there. He's going to work hard every game. And I'm sure every Steeler fan and every fan of football probably came out of that game with only more respect for Steven Jackson. Runs hard every play. That game was out of hand in the third quarter, and he's still pounding it. And on the day, he finished with 24 carries and 103 yards. And we talked about it before we got on air here. Two of those carries were third and 12s, where he gained third and big yardage situations, where he gained 12 yards on the very first series of the game. And then in the third quarter, he had a third and 12, where I think he gained 15 yards. Both of them around right end. Let's start with the Rams side and the Steelers defense. Are you concerned about the Steelers run defense when a team kind of is impotent of an offensive line as the Rams, but with a very good back, but a team you know is going to try to run the ball, is able to move the ball on the ground against you?
I am, when you have someone like Jason Worlds in there who you know, they were double teaming him a couple of times, and he just getting pancaked on the outside. You had Keenan Lewis kind of overplaying the run on those third downs when he's the left outside corner there, and you know, on nickel downs, William Gay shifts inside. You had him kind of overplaying to run inside and getting caught up inside. Timmons, you know, look at it this way. You know, in a 3-4 defense, your defensive linemen are supposed to hold the point of attack, you know, as best they can, and you let the linebackers eat. Well, the linebackers did not eat this week, and plain and simple, I know Timmons ended up with 10, you know, combined tackles, 7 solo, 3 assists in this game, but I thought there were times where he you know, kind of missed the gaps and all like that.
I'm with you 100%. I didn't think he played particularly well again.
And you have Farrier did not have his best game either, and normally a strength of Farrier is filling these gaps. Now, a lot of this, you know, normally they're seeing people come straight up to shoot usually at them between the, you know, 4-6 hole or whatnot. You know, I think around the edge is where it causes problems, because Worlds a few times, especially on those third downs, you know, he's rushing up the field as if it's a pass, having to try to spin off the block. And there's nobody there in that hole. Now, Troy had some nice stops when he came up. Ryan Clark, not terribly as good of a game coming up in run support. He flew by a couple of stops I thought he might have been able to make in this game. So his run defense, not good. Keenan Lewis, although he only played like 13 snaps in the game, not good as well either. We mentioned Timmons and we mentioned World. So, you know, Ziggy Hood, not his best game, but like I told you before we got on the air as well, too, I think that was about Ziggy's fourth best game this year all the way around. I thought Casey Hampton played a good game. I thought Brett Kiesel played a good game. Most of their running, as you said, seemed to be on the right side, and they kind of surprised us a few times, I think, on some third downs.
Yeah, when you got a guy like Kellen Clements, who's been with the team since however long he's been there, 4 weeks or something like that, and you know, you want to make them throw the ball. So look, good on them for some for adjusting the play calling and catching the Steelers a couple times. But I thought particularly in the third quarter, it was slightly distressing to watch the Rams really just drive the ball down the field. They got a few breaks with penalties and they completed a pass or two. But I was just surprised late in the game that the Steelers weren't able to just shut that stuff down and do a better job. Now, having said that, we now had two NFC West teams come in. The two that came into Pittsburgh both put zeros up on the scoreboard for the season. So it's hard to be too critical. But how about the other side of the ball, Dave? This is an offensive line, and we're, you know, clearly the story that kind of has gotten lost a little bit because of some other things going on and late in the season. The story really is Marcus Gilbert not getting the start. Tomlin said in his post-game press conference that he didn't practice or prepare professionally. It turns out that he missed a meeting, which I don't know if that means he was a few minutes late or he slept through it or didn't even make it to the Steelers practice facility. I'm not sure I've heard more than the fact that he missed a meeting, which is a pretty damning thing for a young kid to do. And, you know, he had a big task in front of him. With Chris Long there on left defensive end, and Jonathan Scott got the start, and he's playing right tackle, and Doug Ligurski goes down on the second play of the game, and Trey Essex, who's not played a down of his NFL career at center, comes in, and the offensive line does a bang-up job.
I really thought they did play good. I thought Trey Essex, fantastic moving over to center. I tell you what surprised me in this game. Jonathan Scott's not going to grade out the best in this game because I think I had him about three pressures in this game. His pass blocking is what's going to get him every time. But run blocking wise, I thought he did good. What surprised me was what they did with Ramon Foster. They ran that counter lead back to the left side probably five or six times on the day with some success too. So that means Max Starks had a good game out there as well. Foster really looked good on the move, and that's normally the Steelers' bread and butter, running that counter lead and that counter pike to the right hand side. They did run it a few times with Chris Kimoato in here, and hey, that was a great game by Chris Kimoato just because there was no flags on him.
Yeah, right.
In this game, so at least the arrow's pointing in the right direction there, as Mike Tomlin likes to say. I thought the offensive line did play well. Tomlin made sure to tip his hat to him, and that might have been Essex's best game of the year at center there. So,
it certainly was his best game of the year. He was, I think I actually was listening to Charlie Batch speak today, and he said, Trey has taken, don't think that he hasn't played any center. He was running with the scout team a lot of the season, running as the center, and obviously he's working with Charlie Batch. So there was some familiarity there, which was very good. But, there was never a bobbled snap. He was making the line calls, doing all the things that in that system the Steelers required their center to do. And I have to say, I was awfully impressed.
Yeah, and stick this in a bit. We need Marquise Pouncey back for the playoffs. I think that's pretty obvious. But, being that we're showing success now running to that left side on those counter leads, and when Doug Legursky is back at, assuming he gets over this shoulder strain, which he should, imagine being kind of ambidextrous, being able to run that counter lead to both sides. What a nightmare that causes some defenses, to being able to do that with some success. So I was ecstatic to see them to be able to do that. I think Ramon Foster has really played some good ball this year at right guard once again. I think coming out of the game, a few negatives on some run blocks, but overall that was good. You mentioned Marcus Gilbert too. He did get into the game for two snaps. And let me tell you, he got the message because on one of those, the touchdowns, I can't remember. I think it was the minute.
Yeah, that was the Mendon Hall right up the middle run.
Yeah, and he totally got off the ball like a bolt of lightning. He turned his man inside, and Mendon Hall ran through there with good low pad level behind his pads and an easy touchdown there. And Gilbert was in one other time as well, too. So, I have no problems Tomlin sending messages like that. Remember, he sent one to Mendon Hall a few years ago into Cincinnati about his preparedness and preparation on. Yes, it was a missed meeting on this. I'm sure Marcus Gilbert got the message, and I'm sure he'll get the start this next week again. This coming Sunday against the Browns.
Yep. So good to see the Steelers run game. Good to point out that all three guys who carried the ball were effective. As you pointed out, Redmond is just very tough to bring down. And Jonathan Clay.
He's going to the Pro Bowl.
I got to tell you, he's leading the league on touchdowns per carry and average yards per carry at 10, and he's averaging a touchdown every carry. Nice to see the kid get his first carry and really waltz into the end zone. It was a nice run. He had a hole there. He picked his hole really well and got in there. I guess what my question for you, Dave, is that was early in the game after Mendenhall's 52-yard run, so I can understand that Mendenhall's a little gassed and comes out. But why is Clay getting the call there and not Redmond?
I thought about this. I think John Clay had probably such a good week of practice leading up to here. I think he probably handled it as professional as he could leading up to this week. And I think that the coaching staff just wanted to say, kind of throw him in the game all of a sudden there just to see how mentally prepared he was for this situation. I think it was a test. I don't think it goes anything against Isaac Redmond. I think they just want to say, okay, kid, get in there, get in there.
Do
your thing, as if it was any other down, as if he had played, every game this season. And I really, really think that's what it was.
Well, it was interesting because he didn't get on the field again. he didn't see another play, not another carry. So
he didn't see another carry, but he was on the field for three total plays.
Yep. So it'll be interesting to see how much action he gets against Cleveland, particularly if the Steelers are able to get a lead going. If he gets any carries, I would think if the Steelers get a decent lead in this game in the fourth quarter, they'd like to rest Mendenhall a little bit. But good to see Mendenhall running hard. I thought he had a really good game. I tweeted this during the game that I think Mendenhall and Swisham are the two most underappreciated Steelers. Certainly they haven't done everything perfectly or we wouldn't be having the conversation because there are things to be critical of. But I do think these guys bring a lot more to the table than the average fan gives them credit for.
You know what, Dave? I think that was Mendenhall's best game of the season, to be honest with you. He really ran hard. He did all the little things out of the backfield as well, too. His pass blocking's been good all year. I've never been worried about that. And it's a props to the line, too. I mean, the guy really ran hard, and that's all you can ask for him, to not dance as much and to hit these holes hard like Redmond does. And Isaac Redmond, he's another one that really, I like to talk like he's, bowling ball with feet, because that guy hardly ever comes down on first contact. And we saw Mendenhall kind of do the same in this game as well, too. Really, really tough to come bring down on first contact. And hey, let's face it, David, the running game is not what's going to make the Steelers win their seventh championship here. But it is nice to be able to lean on it at certain points of the game.
Absolutely. And this is, and we talk about it in late season football, and for a Steeler team that particularly likes to get leads and grind things out, to have it, have it be effective. And granted, again, you're right, it's against the worst defense in the league. So we don't want to, take too much away from this, but look, it was effective, and that's what matters.
What about Antonio Brown? What about that fake punt?
Definitely the play of the game in my mind. This is a St. Louis team that you want to get, a team that's 2-12 coming in. You want to get them down. You want to get them thinking about the offseason. You don't want to give them a glimmers of hope. And in their first drive, they moved the ball a little bit, and then Mike Tomlin, a challenge that worked out perfectly. Ike Taylor had some good coverage on that play, and it was a very close challenge. I mean, Dan Fouts, the announcer on NBC, didn't think they should, or on NBC.
I think that was Fox.
Fox, right. Of course, it wasn't NBC. Fouts said that he thought the call shouldn't have been overturned. I thought it should have been overturned, but it was close, and I could have seen the other point of view. So they didn't get the catch. They didn't get the run after the catch, so they didn't get the first down. The Steelers got the ball and moved the ball down the field. And then the Rams move it again, and they're down there, and Antonio Brown makes a fantastic play as the punt returner, coming up and tackling the punter after a 10-yard gain on a 4th and 12.
He had to come about 37, 38 yards, I think. And now, of course, the punter's looking to pass first, so you have that kind of delay before he's taken off with it. But, and I know it was the punter that you're tackling too, but great form. And, that could have been a game-changing play, had he made that, and if they continue on the drive to score and put up 7 on the board, So, yeah, really great game. And Antonio Brown, not only that, on that end-around option pass of his where he was dead in the water, he gets positive yardage out of there. And the kid just continues to make plays. And we mentioned, too, the bubble screen. We were wondering why the Steelers didn't have any bubble screens against the 49ers. Well, lo and behold, we get some this week. A couple of them went for good yards. I think one of them kind of blew up on them there, but that's going to happen from time to time. But overall, I love the game plan. I love the mixing up of the run and the short pass. I thought Charlie dodging a couple of those bullets with the pressure there and still extending the play and making something out of it. I'm not convinced Ben gets away from a couple of those.
Oh, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. I definitely think Charlie's mobility was a big help in the game on Saturday.
And also, Dave, what about the slipping that was going on out there? What did I know you weren't at the game. You sat this one out. But what did you think about all the players slipping all over the place?
Well, I was not happy watching the game, seeing that happen. Because, look, I played soccer, and it's a game. you know, you're spending a lot of time cutting all the time and you're running. And one of the things you do before you go out and play is you spend time working the field and seeing what kind of cleats are going to work best. And these guys have played enough football on enough different surfaces, and particularly when it's your home field, that I really find it, somewhat inexcusable for the player. I'll put some of it on the training staff, but I'll put more of it on the player to know what cleats are going to work for you. And you get a certain you have different length studs, and you have molded shoes, and you have different, you know, different shoes you can wear, and you just don't want to see that. Now, if the sod is giving out underneath you, that's a little bit of a different story. I mean, if you're planning and it's not, your foot is sliding, it's the sod itself is moving, then there's nothing you can do about that. So, you know, I don't want to be overly critical without knowing all the answers, but it certainly happened occasionally to the Rams, but it looked like it was happening to the Steelers much more often, particularly early in the game. The DBs were going down, and obviously that's dangerous stuff. Your DBs go down, and, you know, those are touchdowns going the other way. So, you know, we'll see what happens here if the Steelers have another home game or two. We haven't seen much of it this year, but it definitely looked like it was affecting how the play went.
Let's talk about a couple other negatives in the game.
Steelers. Hey, Dave, before we get away from Antonio Brown, how about the fact that this was totally under the radar, and I didn't know it coming in, but he broke the single-season all-purpose yardage record. Maybe not the most important record in the books, particularly because he gets an advantage that not a lot of guys get in terms of returning kickoffs and returning punts, and you don't often see guys who are regulars, big-time contributors to the offense play that role, but a nice little feather in his cap getting that record.
Yeah, passed Barry Foster, I believe, with that, with the all-purpose yards, and of course, he did pass the 1,000-yard mark on the season as well, too, reception-wise. And hey, let's face it, this is a kid that's still making a few mistakes here and there. The false starts, the uncovering the tight ends, I think, with the illegal formations or whatnot. We've talked about some of his route running throughout the year here. This kid is still not, fully where he needs to be yet. So, you know, imagine what's going to happen with another year up underneath his belt going forward here. I mean, the sky's the limit. This kid might actually be more of an all-around, well, he already is, I think, now a better all-around receiver possibly than Mike Wallace is. And speaking of Mike Wallace, what did you think on the third down and goal play early in the game on the Steelers' first drive? I thought that was a great play call. I like the quick slant to Mike Wallace there in the end zone. He had single coverage there. Wallace has got to do a better job of using his body to shield off the defender there.
Yeah, absolutely. I tweeted that during the game that was a good throw. He's got man coverage. Once he gets an inside shoulder on him, he's got to make sure he keeps his left shoulder driven into the defender, and he can turn that when he wants to make the play. He's got to shield that off. I thought he had two choices there. It looked to me like he kind of high-stepped and went up to kind of cushion the ball into his stomach, which that makes it much harder to defend that, to move off that defender. So he either has to take a little bit more of a diagonal route, or he's just got to do a better job of getting his butt and shoulder into that guy so that he can catch that ball with his hands. And you know, you said rightly so, that the DB did make a good play on it, but that's touchdown time. You want your receivers fighting like crazy, and I think there are a couple other guys on the Steelers roster who would have really liked to, they would have fought harder for that ball. So I want to see Mike Wallace fight harder for that ball.
Yeah, what about the even the long bomb, even though it was underthrown by Charlie Batch and all, he Mike's really got to start high-pointing these balls better. Because
he caught that at his waist level. If that DB gets a hand in there, there's no way he catches that.
And he catches it in his breadbasket. Go back and rewatch the play again. He almost dropped that ball.
Yep. I was looking when he hit the ground just to make sure that he didn't roll on it, because he rolled under his shoulder, fortunately. But, yeah, he did not have possession when he was going to the ground.
Yeah, so, I would like to see him start high-pointing the ball better, because let's face it, he's going to see, you're going to be able to see, I think, it shift back in his favor a little bit more now that Antonio Brown's come on. You got Jericho Cotri contributing. Lord knows, I think we should get Emmanuel Sanders back for the playoffs, so it should loosen up Mike Wallace here, a little bit more going forward and all. Hines Ward, let's get to some negatives here first. The 1-for-7 on third down.
Not much to say. It's, Charlie, I like, as you said, I like the play calling as well in general that we saw. The third down conversions, you know, Charlie is not great, I think, throwing the ball under pressure into situations. That was the best stuff we saw out of him was, you know, we caught him with by surprise on the long ball to Wallace. Really moved the ball much better in the second half than the first half, and I think they opened the game plan up on the early downs. So, you know, I think in obvious passing situations, you know, Charlie's not the perfect guy to have there, and they didn't get it done. And that's, you know, since the Kansas City game, really, the Steeler offense has been, what's the right word, inept at converting third downs. They really haven't done a good job.
Yeah, and I think that's the rhythm and all that we've talking about. Now, you know, Ben's been banged up as well, too, along the way here. So that's why a little bit I'd like to get Ben back in here for some of this Browns game. But I think we had, what, 4-3 and outs in this game. One of the three play drives ended in a touchdown, so you know there's nothing wrong with that. That's a 3-3 into the scoreboard. But I think we had, let's see, 4-3 and outs in the game that kind of led to that low third down conversion rate there. So that, you know, that's something to take away negative there. Back on the positive side, James Harrison really manhandled Adam Goldberg, I thought, well in this game, and I've got a breakdown of that. It wasn't a sack, but boy, it sure was close, and he literally almost used Adam Goldberg as a weapon to sack Kellen Clemens with on that play, and I was really impressed with the play of Harrison in this game. It will be so nice, and I sure hope that Lamar Woodley, by them trying to fool around with getting him some snaps over the last few weeks, I sure hope he's 100% heading into the playoffs, because they need him 100% on the opposite side. I think the Steelers' defense will really, really be brutal if you can have both those guys in the playoffs and healthy. So I don't expect Lamar to be back this week against the Browns, but I sure hope they haven't done any damage to him.
Yeah, you know, hard to say. But they said, he played some of that game. After the, which game was it? Some of the San Francisco game.
Fatigued.
They chose to rest him again, and we'll see what happens in practice this week. It sounds like he's good to go. Tomlin has given the team off until Wednesday, so I'm not sure how much of a more updated injury report we'll get tomorrow at his press conference. I'm sure we'll get something, because the injured guys are obviously coming in and meeting with the trainers and that kind of thing, but we won't have anything on the practice report until after Wednesday's practice. Dave, let's get to the elephant in the Steeler in Steeler Nation right now. It's Hines Ward. It continues to be Hines Ward. It's going to be Hines Ward. And I'll give you a new take on this. I have been pretty much – this is a non-issue for me. I think it would have been nice had they gotten him a few more passes. But if Hines does or does not get 1,000 receptions, it's not going to affect my view of either him as a player, B, the organization, or anything else. These things, if I asked any Steeler fan, except for somebody who has the record book in front of them, how many catches John Stallworth, Lynn Swann, Ron Shankland, Frank Lewis, any Steeler, Louis Lips, name a Steeler, if I asked you how many receptions they had, they couldn't tell me. This is just a moment in time where it's a nice round number of 1,000, and then it's going to be forgotten about forever. But why I think this matters so much is there's a tacit understanding now amongst Steeler fans that Hines Ward's not going to be back next year. This is why it matters. Of course, if he's going to be back next year and that wasn't an issue, nobody would be talking about this. If this were number 500 and it's his sixth season or eighth season in the NFL, we wouldn't be having this conversation. The reason is because Hines Ward's not coming back in a Steeler uniform, so they want to see him get number 1,000 right here and then be done with it. I think that's kind of the underlying thing.
I wouldn't say I think the possibility of him not coming back, I think it's just a realization that there is a distinct possibility that he might not be back. But Hines is saying that he wants to play again.
Well, come on.
He's not going to play. He's not going to play at $4 million a season. I can tell you that. I mean, something's going to have to change there. I just cannot see. He's going to have to either. They're going to have to redo some contract or something there for him to come back.
Do you want him back as your fifth receiver? Is there any chance of a distraction at that point? Let me just ask you, these are hypotheticals. Do you want him back as your fifth receiver at $2 million? And do you think he is willing to kind of take that role and have a you know, say, look, Hines, you're the fifth receiver. That's what you're going to be. We've got four guys who we like who are coming back. Now, Cotri obviously is not under contract, so there's a question mark there. But under that scenario, would you want him back?
I'd want him back if I can get him as a fourth or fifth receiver. Absolutely, I would. The price would have to be right, though. And but there, you know, Hines still thinks he can play too, and Hines can still play on some certain situations. We saw it on a one of those third downs of his.
I don't know that catching a ball means you can still play.
He can find the soft areas of the zone still. I mean, he's not a guy that's going to put up seven catches for 90 yards for you anymore. No, but I think he can be a guy that can come in and four receiver sets though, and you know, kind of be a bailout, sit down in the soft area zone and get you a first down.
You're going to be a year older next year.
They said that this year, man. I mean, he has lost a step. He's always had that kind of hitch in a step anyway. He's a guy though, still. I mean, if you put him out there in the four receiver set, he's a guy that can find the soft area zone and move the chains. Now, does that mean he gets nine snaps, you know, times 16 weeks next year? Possibly. Will he want to play for that? Is that worth $2 million? Probably not. So it is a realization. But hey,
then the other question is, since he's not really a special teams guy, can you afford to be carrying him on the roster?
It depends on how this salary cap number shakes out, which I've posted quite a bit. We'll get into that more in depth, but you know, that number is not going to go up, to my understanding, much more than it was last year. Those new TV contracts, I don't think, kick in until after another season or so is when that money actually starts coming in. So they're going to be up against the cap. So they're going to have to do something with his contract for him to return.
Yeah.
And let's face it, even though he says he returned, if they win this Super Bowl, why wouldn't he walk away?
Sure. I mean, you got all sorts of different issues, and we'll get into those. So so here we got Cleveland coming in.
Hey, one more thing on Hines Ward. I have a breakdown of that one coming across the middle there, that hit by Laurinaitis. Should Laurinaitis get fined?
I don't think so. I mean, one of the things, we got an email from one of our followers in Canada, and we appreciate the email. And one of the things that I think is confusing for all of us is when we talk about when is a guy defenseless and when is a guy allowed to be hit in the head. And the NFL is going to run into this problem over time, much like the NHL has now. The NHL has made it has not just said any hit to the head's illegal. And as we've found with the NFL, you hit a quarterback in the head, it's illegal. You hit a defenseless receiver pretty much anywhere, but particularly in the head, that's illegal. But if you hit a running back in the head, or a receiver running with the ball, or even a quarterback running with the ball in the head, that's legal. These now are creating finer lines for referees to make decisions that are going to be harder and harder. And how, as a sport, can you say, well, you can't hit that guy in the head, but you can hit this guy in the head? And that's when I think the game is going to be tough, if concussions continue to be a big problem and there's a big focus on them. So what I think what happened with Hines there is he was going to the ground, so his head is constantly moving through that process. I don't think he was defenseless in the sense that he had caught the ball and was, you know, making a slide. Now, I guess you could make an argument, did Laurinaitis spear him? I didn't think at the time that it was a, you know, intent to injure or spear. Did he get him in the head? Absolutely, no question about it. But I'd be surprised if he got fined.
Well, and I messed up, and I used the word bias in that post. You know, I'm just trying to you know, and I still don't think there's a lot of bias going on here. Some is creeping into my head, I got to admit, especially over the last few weeks. I know we talked about this several weeks ago with the Ryan Clark hit and all like that. Well, we both kind of agreed that. You know, we don't think there's a bias towards the Steelers. And a reader of my blog kind of posted up there, hey, didn't you guys say that you agree that there was no bias towards the Steelers? I will admit there's some creeping in my head here. I think what the real problem is here, though, is the consistency of what's getting called and what's not getting called. And it does always look like the questionable ones go against the Steelers. So take that for what you – and I posted this Laurinaitis just to get some kind of attention on it, okay? you know, especially since Carl Johnson came out with his video a couple of weeks ago saying how players need to hit lower. And technically, I think if you looked at that video again and looked at the full play of the Laurinaitis hit on Hines Ward, that would classify as an illegal hit, if you ask me. So his head was just come around with the ball. He was going down to the ground. There was no way he was going to protect himself from that hit, in my opinion. So that, in my opinion, makes him a defenseless receiver. And Laurinaitis definitely hit him helmet to helmet. You can see Hines' neck snap back there. It's amazing he didn't get a concussion on that play. So, I messed up. I use the word bias. It's just just the inconsistency of some of these hits just absolutely drive me crazy.
Yeah, and I think this is going to be harder and harder for all officials to be making these calls, because the more judgment you put into it, the more skeptical the fan base becomes, and the harder I think it is. And we see it with pass interference all the time, and it's something I'm sure the NFL is going to look at much more closely this offseason. It is such a tough call to make, just like offensive holding. Virtually every play, there's a defensive lineman or linebacker being held, and virtually every pass, there's, some level of hand-to-hand contact between the receiver and the defensive back, and when is it interference, and when is it holding, and when is it, when is it flagrant interference? Maybe if they want to kind of grade the judgments, they've gone away from that with face mask calls. Everything's a flagrant, a personal foul, which I think is a pretty good idea. It'll be interesting to see if they try to gradate the pass interference calls, because that's going to cause, trust me, that's going to cause a ton of consternation if it does, depending on how referees are able to make those calls.
Well, we talked a few weeks after the McCoy hit. Should we just go ahead and just put, helmet to helmet on receivers after a catch as a no-no?
Well, again, the question is, if a guy moves his head down to meet your helmet, which we see running backs do all the time, it amazes me. Running backs put their head down to meet the defensive backs or the linebacker's helmet. I don't know how you can do it. I just don't know how you can do it, because I think oftentimes it's the offensive player who initiates that kind of contact.
Or should there be something to the effect that the receiver has to, because the receiver is lowering his head thinking a hit's coming for the most part.
Yeah, protecting his chest in the middle of his body as well.
And that's what happened to Ryan Clark, in my opinion, there on that one hit. But, it's just the inconsistency that's driving me crazy. And then you have something like that Abram Elam a few weeks ago against the Buccaneers late in that game that I posted about that, too. I'm looking for anything I can post about on these just to find a hypocrisy in some of this. And sure, I'm reaching on a few of them, I admit it. But it just drives me so batty that the inconsistency that even I, the fan who've been watching football for all these years, would see a hit and don't even know if it's going to be constituted as a legal hit or an illegal hit, or if the player's going to get fined. And if I know, I'm kind of curious about that. I can imagine what the guy is who just watches, a couple of games on Sunday.
No question. And we see it in the replay reviews. I know people in the Jets-Giants game are going crazy about some of those fumbles not being called, and then the tuck rule, and what's is that the most ridiculous rule in the game? It's one of those things. The NFL, it's never been as popular as it is now. It's never had more money flowing into it than it does now. But there are certainly, and I think they have generally done good things to protect players and to make the game safer, to make the game more entertaining. But there's still a lot of stuff that you and I obviously would both like to see clarified and them do a better job. And it's hard for me to believe, as often as they do, even when they go to the replay, they apparently, even from the league's own edict afterward, they apparently still aren't getting things right. And that's the kind of stuff that, we find inexcusable. And just to throw another one out there, the Calvin Johnson touchdown last year that we've seen a couple times this year, where a guy goes into the end zone with the ball, he's got to go to the ground and then come up and basically, mug for the camera. And if he drops the ball at any point in the time, they call off the touchdown. It might cost the Bengals a playoff spot. With Grisham and the touchdown that you talked about in the Ravens game, they ended up losing that game. Not that they necessarily would have won it, but they had a better chance to win. And, that could totally reverse how the Steelers, Bengals, and Ravens would be going into this weekend about who would be in control and what would be going on because of a guy, I think, mistakenly making a call.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And they're just, the tuck rule, too, you mentioned in that game the other day, and then for Ben, the one in the San Francisco game, for that not to be applied, the tuck rule, You know, I just don't see where they're finding the differences in a lot of these, and somebody needs to get a hold of the Rules Committee and just kind of straighten this crap out. Packers' performance last night, is this, you know, are they, should we go ahead and put them in the Super Bowl?
I don't think so. I think playing at home is a big advantage. I think New Orleans is capable of, I think their New Orleans defense is better. One of the things I've said is there's no question that New England can beat any team they play, particularly if they get them at home, because as bad as they played in the first half, they can put up 30 points, 35 points, 40 points on anybody. Green Bay can do the same thing. I think New Orleans can do the same thing, although they'll have more trouble doing it on the road. So I'm not ready to put him in. I do think that I think it's silly for people to think that the Niners can compete with those two teams. Now we'll see, but I think either the Lions or the Falcons will give the Niners a good game in San Francisco when they play, and certainly one of those teams certainly wants to finish fourth or fifth rather than sixth, because you get the Cowboys or the Giants at home, or you got to go to San Francisco. And I think anybody right now would take playing the Cowboys or the Giants for that seed. So that'll be interesting to see. But I think that the Saints and the Green Bay are kind of clearly, in my mind, the two best teams out there. And then on our side, it's anybody's ballgame.
I think the Patriots and the Steelers are the two teams that if either New Orleans or the Packers make it to the Super Bowl for the NFC, I think the only two teams that could beat either one of those two teams are the Patriots and Steelers. And Steelers have the much better defense, of course, but the
Patriots are going to have to do it by scoring 55.
Which they can do.
Right.
You know, so now the Ravens, hey, you know, I know we hate them and all like that. I just don't think that's the team. I don't think they're explosive enough. The Texans, ever since they lost Matt Schaub, I would have put them up there as a team that could have possibly do that because their defense is damn good. I think they might, you know, they have an outside chance of maybe making it to the AFC Championship, the Texans do. Same with the Ravens there, if the Steelers don't crack them. Denver, let's face it. I mean, Denver, if their defense doesn't show up to play and keep them, you know, for some late miracles, I just don't see it with them, nor do I see any other team in the AFC making any noise.
Yeah, and Dave, I'll tell you just an interesting fact as we close up here. The Steelers have only given up more than 20 points to one team in the NFL in their 15 games so far, and it was to the Ravens in both games, 35 in the first week, 23 in the second week. Otherwise, they haven't given up 20 points. Now, they haven't played a ton of good teams, and they certainly haven't beaten a ton of good teams. They beat New England. We would argue that when they beat Seattle, we all thought Seattle was a terrible team. I think Seattle's a pretty good team right now. Arizona's an average team. Cincinnati's maybe a little above average, but the win against New England's a good win. But, you know, that Steeler defense, as you said, if they get both outside linebackers back, they come in relatively healthy, and the Steelers get Sanders and Ben back for the playoffs, anything can happen. But, you know, it looks like right now we're going to be going out to Denver or going out to Oakland January 8th or 9th.
But keep the faith. Stranger things have happened. Here's an amazing thing is what the Steelers have done this year, despite the negative turnover differential that they have. I think people just lose fact so much about you know, those takeaways and what it means to give an offense a short field and turning those into punts and I mean into points. And the Steelers are a negative 12, right down there at the bottom. You know. I don't think people give the offense enough credit for what they've done despite that negative 12 turnover differential.
Yeah, and of course, seven of those were in the first week. But, yeah, they've been, you know, that just goes to show you that in the rest of the season they've gone, 11-3 and with a negative 5 turnover differential. Pretty, as you say, pretty impressive stuff.
Yeah, because and they're gonna need turnovers in the playoffs to make a dent. I mean, let's face it, anything – if you're not getting turnovers in the playoffs and you're turning the ball over, you're going to lose games.
So just one last thing for you. As you were talking about the Packers, how astonishing is the stat that on the season they've been out? And this goes to your point again about getting short fields and creating turnovers and doing a lot of the things the Packers have done that the Steelers haven't done. But they have been outgained on the season, and they're 14-1.
Yeah, I think that's a deceiving stat once again because of the turnovers and the short field. Because of it, you know, and let's face it, the Green Bay Packers defense have been kind of feast and famine. They either get the turnover or they give up some big plays. I've said it all year that if you look at those talk stats and all too, they're them, you know, they're not above giving up the big play, as is New Orleans, their defense, as is definitely New England's defense. The Steelers' defense has been good about not giving up the explosive play. They're just not getting turnovers. So that is a rarity, but, you know, there is a reason behind that stat and why, you know, there is a reason behind it.
Yep. Well, Dave, as I mentioned in our show on Friday, I will be doing filling in for Joe Bendel tomorrow on ESPN 970 in Pittsburgh from 4 to 7. You and I are going to talk about you being a guest on that show, and I hope our listeners will tune in and certainly give us some calls. It's a chance. I know we don't take a lot of calls here. We take some emails, but you get a chance to talk some Steeler football tomorrow from 4 to 7.
Can't wait.
Can't wait. All right. Anything to close this out with?
No, I think I get it. We'll have we'll try to get the Browns beat writer back on for the Wednesday show again. Follow us on Twitter at Steelers Depot, at Hammer Speaks, at Terrible Podcast. You can email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. Hit us up on the hotline. All the usual things. And we appreciate everybody listening. We get a lot of good feedback on the show, and it makes us feel good.
Episode 61, Season 2. Thanks for listening to The Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.